The Disciplined Investor is underwritten by Interactive Brokers. Interactive Brokers charges U.S. dollar margin loan rates from 0.75% to 1.59%. Of course, rates are subject to change. Learn more at ibkr.com/compare.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Meme stocks deflated, but markets turn higher to start the month. Tech stocks continue to post impressive earnings, and the $1.9 trillion stimulus plan looks promising. And our guest today, Anthony Pompliano. All this and much more on episode number 700 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to February. Here we are. Hopefully you're staying warm and your portfolio is insulated away from some of the recent, I guess we'll call it volatility, which was a lot more than just simple volatility, of course. For those of you that are first timers, I'm your host, Andrew Horowitz. And to put this all into perspective, the first Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number one, was 14 years ago, March 1st, I think it was March 1st, of 2007 is where this all began. And we are talking about 700 episodes, over 400 guests, tens of millions of downloads, tens of thousands of people listening, getting financial education, information, understanding about what they can do to help with their future in terms of investing, to become more disciplined. And I want to say thank you. Thank you because you've made this possible. You've kept on listening and giving us great reviews. By the way, if you haven't done so, go over to iTunes or wherever it is and post a review of the podcast. I'd really appreciate that. But basically, this is all about providing a great deal of insight. And if you didn't know this, it's not only insight for you, it's great information for me too, because I get to speak to some of the best people in the industry talking about all sorts of things related to the area of finance that I may have not known about, and I get an education too. So it's really awesome, and we have a great guest coming up today that I've been looking forward to talking to for a long time. We're going to be talking about the area of, well, I guess we'll call it DeFi and digital assets, et cetera. So we'll talk about that. We're going to have to celebrate too. I don't know how we're going to celebrate when it comes up. March is going to be the anniversary, the 14-year anniversary. So if you want, give me some ideas on how we can celebrate this. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button, and just right away, tell me what you think. All right. I want to talk about a couple of things, and I want to talk about these meme stocks, the GameStop, the AMC, the Build-A-Bear, the BlackBerry, the Koss. These are the names, obviously, that really caught the attention and almost mesmerized people, right? We were all fixated during the week. I'm like, what is going on? And aside from the massive drawdowns that we saw on those names, you know, these they call them meme stocks, GameStop. It's kind of a bit of a tongue twister there. So what else is going on? Because this caught the attention last week, but yet this week it deflated a bit. Well, the markets now, the S&P and the NASDAQ, are hitting all-time highs. We rebounded after a very tough week, a month, where I think there was a lot of concern about the potential for short covering and for squeezes, margin calls, hedge funds having to liquidate, and that caused a lot of problems. But everybody's like, well, is that it? Is that it for the correction? Is that all we get here? Not that any of us are necessarily looking for a correction, maybe looking for one, but not wanting one. Well, maybe. We know there's plenty of money out there. There's much more to come. We have this $1.9 trillion stimulus bill that looks like it has a pretty good chance of just sailing right through. Went through the reconciliation process that's going to require only 50% or a simple majority of Senate votes. It looks like we're going to have, or we had, the first tie by vice president in a long time, as they are, as the vice president breaks the tie in the Senate. So just getting it right through. And yes, this is shoving it right down the throats of the Republicans, who all of a sudden have become fiscally responsible. You know, when the Republicans had the opportunity to do so, they didn't. Yet the Democrats were squawking and squealing and saying all sorts of things about, we can't be, keep spending all this. We got to be more targeted. We can't just kind of lay it out there. And now when the Democrats want to do it, well, the Republicans are trying to be fiscally responsible, saying, hey, we got to target this. So you have to realize that this whole thing is just a bunch of BS. The politics behind all of this is just crap. And if we put that aside, maybe we could be better investors, not looking for what it is that any administration or Congress or any politician is saying. Yeah, we have to look at the totality of it all, because if we do, we can find, okay, well, it looks like there's going to be some more infrastructure spending. Maybe we'll look to the areas that will benefit there. And maybe we'll think about, hey, you know what? All these checks that are going out, the $1,400 plus the potential for elongated and additional amounts for unemployment. Well, if that goes to September, then we got to think about the retail market starting to heal a little bit. And not to mention the pent-up demand, about the excess that's actually going into the system directly. So all that does make sense. But, you know, the platforms and the crosstalk is just something to ignore. So in the wake of this that we see here, the $900 billion that we recently got on top, and then potentially for another initiative, you have to realize that as this went through the way it did, you have to wonder if the Democrats are going to be empowered now to think about that they can maybe get some of their other initiatives through very easily as well. And you have to watch out, because there's been some talk about the potential for an increase in taxes, because somehow, somewhere, someday, we're going to have to pay for all this. Which is why we're seeing the debasement of the dollar. You're seeing things like the alt currencies or the cryptos move up dramatically. Over the weekend, we saw that Bitcoin capped out over 40,000 again. Gold and silver had a little bit of a rough week because there's some weird things going on there, but yet at the same time holding up relatively well. Yeah, we saw a better employment picture emerge this week on Friday. The unemployment numbers came out, and even as they adjusted the previous month and actually added a lot more people that were unemployed, in other words, it was worse than it was first reported. Somehow, magically, by the art and science of statistics, the unemployment rate went from 6.7% to 6.3%, with only 49,000 new additions. Now, how is that? Well, again, this is a statistical anomaly that's related to the labor participation rate, how they calculate this, as well as the fact that all the people that are not in the jobs market any longer, they've been extracted due to how you fill out your unemployment initial claim form. What happened is that these people are considered no longer in the workforce. And therefore, when you do the calculation, it looks like there's less of a drag on the employment situation. They're no longer unemployed. Therefore, we can get a 6.3 when we adjust last month down and only add 49,000 to this month. So there's no need to really fight the headline. All that matters right now is the fact that we are seeing that markets have a lot of liquidity. There is a lot more being pumped in from low interest rates as well as stimulus. And there is a bit of a euphoria. Every dip is bought. And at the same time, you can't discount that we saw some spectacular earnings. I mean, Amazon's numbers were absolutely beautiful. Yeah, Jeff Bezos is stepping aside from the CEO position, still maintaining the chairman position. I don't know if that's going to really change a lot, but Their numbers were outstanding. eBay, Microsoft, I mean, the numbers that we are seeing from many of these companies that were able to pivot and really make a bundle off of this pandemic is pretty impressive. You have to respect their ability to really figure out what to do in these very difficult times. And I was thinking about this and I was like, okay, let's look at what else is going on out there. And we know about all these various names, the Teslas and the Microsofts and the Netflix. But there's a name, one of the ones we hold in actually our managed growth strategy portfolio. We've had it for some time. It actually was the best performing NASDAQ stock, I believe, for 2020, up some 800%. Stock is called Digital Turbine, symbol APPS. Now, I bring this up because I want to share something with you in terms of, you know, how do we relate this to the idea of discipline? Now, this company is it's a software platform. It enables mobile operators and OEMs to control and manage and basically monetize devices. I mean, this is the from the cut and paste of what the company does. They provide this programmatic advertising and targeted media delivery services and other products, et cetera. So they're right in there, right? They're right in that sweet spot of the mobile device, the advertising, the installation, the content delivery, et cetera. Well, as I mentioned, we own this for the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, and it's a position that has just had an incredible, incredible move. And we trimmed the position recently, the second time since we've owned it, because the stock has been on look at the chart, nonstop move upward. The company's fundamentals look pretty strong. The growth is outstanding. But why do we do this? Why do we drop or cut some of the positioning? That's the question, because it's part of the risk management process. And that's something important to understand. Now, sure, you could let something just fly and just go and just run and just kind of see where it goes, and hopefully it's going to move up forever and ever and ever. But we know reality. There's some gravity involved with markets. And with this, we thought that in light of what we saw over the last 2 weeks when we saw these incredible pops and drops, although this is a little bit different, of course, this is a fundamentally driven story, you have to be a risk manager, we believe, inside your portfolio. And what you need to do is you need to prune. You need to cut, you need to trim every once in a while. Also add or fertilize or, you know, add to risk when appropriate. But when a stock, let's say, has a position that you target, let's just say, as a 2% position in your portfolio or whatever number you want to pick, 5%, 10%, and it starts to move up 100%, 200%, and it gets outside the boundaries of where you want to hold that, it makes sense to take a little profit off the table. You know, no one ever went bankrupt taking a profit. We know that. Now, we can be pigs. We can keep on just letting this thing go and just let it go. But, you know, if you take off, let's say, 20% of the position, that kind of makes some sense. The process of investing, whether it's in mutual funds or ETFs or stocks, whatever you're doing, is a process of risk management. If not, what's the point? Just throw it all in, go to sleep, wake up 20 years from now, which is also a reasonable thing to do for some people. Maybe you're in your 401k plans and your IRAs as an example. Now, we believe that we need to work the edges. We need to rebalance. We need to readjust. We need to make sure that the portfolio is constantly looking at where the best opportunities are, where the best balance, where the risk reward is, and then make sure it stays within that parameter. So I tell you this because a lot of stocks have really made incredible runs higher. Do we really think that some of the stocks that are up 200, 300% in the last 3 or 4 months are going to necessarily stay there forever? Well, maybe they will. But you know what? We also see the reality set it over time, and those moves on the downside are fast and furious. When you start trimming your position, it allows for you to do a couple of things. Number one, have some cash available for other places that you could put your money that may also benefit. Number two, it also gives you the opportunity that if the stock does come in a little bit, you just carved out a little piece of that profit. And then maybe when it comes in, you could add back to it. So there are a lot of really good reasons why this whole rebalancing process works. You could look to, hey, you know, this stock that I really, really like, has done really well. I'm going to take some of the profit off of there. This other stock I really like has not done as well, but I really have high hopes for it for the future. I'm going to reallocate that asset and put it into this other position. Therefore, selling and taking some of the winners and putting into some of the underperformers that hopefully will do well over time. So I know so much for risk these days, right? But this is a process I think that needs to be adhered to regularly. And, you know, you need to stay vigilant in all this. And I guess we could basically say that trees don't grow to the sky. So why should stocks always go up forever at these rates, at this velocity? It probably can't. Not for every one of them. So think about doing a little bit of a trim, rebalance, if you will, pruning of the excess growth so that we can continue to have a healthy portfolio. Now, many of you have written me about the EV space, and you've written me about SPACs. You've written me about crypto. A lot going on in all those areas with incredibly impressive returns. And this is what we're going to focus in on with our guest today. But first, I want to discuss again a way to earn some extra money on your portfolio position. So let me ask, right? I mean, have you ever considered ways to earn extra income within your portfolio? Well, Interactive Brokers Stock Yield Enhancement Program lets you earn extra income on fully paid shares of stock in your brokerage account. Yep. So here's basically how it works. Interactive Brokers lends your shares to traders who pay interest in order to borrow them. And Interactive Brokers will split that with you 50-50. Whatever the earned income is, they'll split right down the line. Pretty much that simple. Now, this isn't for every portfolio, but there really are those people, especially if you're holding positions, why not think about this opportunity? Because it really makes a lot of sense if you're holding a position and there is this stock yield enhancement program out there that will allow for you to make a little bit of extra money. Whatever it is extra money. So you can open your Interactive Brokers account today and start earning this extra income. And you can learn all about this at ibkr.com/syep. ibkr.com/syep. Just check that out. It's something interesting to consider. All right. How about, I'm pretty excited about this. Let's get to our guest this week and see what he has to say. And our guest today is Anthony Pompliano. And he's an American entrepreneur and investor. He's built and sold numerous companies, ran Procter & Gamble teams in Facebook and Snapchat, invested over $100 million in early-stage tech companies, and he and his partners allocate capital across digital asset classes on behalf of institutional clients, including public pensions, university endowments, private foundations, and large family offices. Plus, he's the host of a very popular podcast called The Pomp Podcast. So bang, bang to you, Anthony.
What's going on, Andrew? Thank you so much for having me.
So I know there's a lot of interest in hearing from you. I bet, by the way, it's kind of cold in South Florida. Are you wearing that black hoodie right now, or are you wearing a suit? What are you doing?
I do not wear suits anymore, but the black hoodie or a black t-shirt is a staple.
Yeah, I gotcha. So let's start right in and talk about what's going on, because I guess we got to start with the Wall Street hack or the heist, you know, the short squeeze on GameStop and that great company, Build-A-Bear, AMC. I mean, you, from what I kind of gathered, maybe I'm wrong, but you're kind of in favor of this, or are you in favor of this whole financial and social justice angle of all this?
I mean, I don't know if I would call it social justice as much as I would call it free markets, right? And so I think the two ways to look at kind of my perspective is, there's a bunch of virtue signaling going on by the legacy market where they're basically saying, we know what things are supposed to be worth. We know how markets are supposed to work. And therefore, anything that violates our view of the world should be shut down, prevented, heavily disincentivized. And I just fundamentally, you know, disagree with that, whether it's regulators, whether it's politicians, or it's just large hedge funds. If you know you really do believe in free markets, then let the market do its thing, you know, open it up. And then I think the second part is The narrative of, oh, the Reddit folks, you know, they're just degenerate gamblers. I think that is a pretty misinformed view of the world. You know, are there people kind of, you know, I call it YOLO long? Of course, right? There's people who are just going in, they're buying options. It's more entertainment than investing. But that's what they choose to do. That's their money. They want to, you know, go risk it, then knock themselves out. They can go buy lottery tickets, go to the casino. If they want to sit at home and play on Robinhood, let them do it. But also, I think that people underestimate some of the intelligence. And so if you go back, you know, on the specific GameStop stuff, and you look at the initial kind of value investor analysis of GameStop that was done 18, 20 months ago, it's pretty high quality. And then if you look at the actual gamma squeeze post, we're basically outlining, look, if we all go buy this, we can basically short squeeze Wall Street. That analysis is the analysis you would expect at a top hedge fund. And so I think that people are just, you know, they kind of fall in line with some of these narratives and they don't actually go look at the source material. But when you look at the source material, it's obvious that there's a lot of really smart people on these forums. And so you just got to kind of remember the world's not black and white. There's a lot of gray. And I think that it's important for people to understand what some of that gray means when there's kind of these outlier market events.
But at the same time, I've read some of these posts and they're nasty. They're stupid. They make no sense. They're angry and they're kind of vicious. I mean, they were looking just to burn down the system, break the bank. And I get all that. I understand this frustration. I don't get the frustration of someone who says, oh man, I've been wronged for Wall Street for 25 years. This is the person that opened up a Robinhood account 6 months ago with $300 in it, right? I don't know what kind of wrongs happened over the last however long to them particularly. And I know people personally who are like, yeah, you know, GameStop, it's going to, you know, create this financial equity. Just keep on buying it. I'm thinking, how is that going to happen?
Yeah, so I definitely think that there is some separation between the kind of the mob mentality in the, you know, if you want to call it kind of the rebels versus how markets work and the amount of capital needed and all those types of things. I continue to remind people that last week, the greatest profiteer from the GameStop saga was Fidelity, right? They're just so big and they got to own so much stuff that they still ended up making more money than anybody else. And then also, you know, the board members, the CEO, like there's people who made a lot of money and it wasn't, you know, necessarily just people sitting on Reddit. But I do think that the feeling of I've been wronged, it's a combination of a lot of things. So Wall Street kind of is the donkey that gets pinned up, you know, on the wall and darts thrown at it. But I think that the more important thing is there's a lot of people who just feel like they can't get ahead, right? And frankly, that's probably less of a Wall Street thing and it's more of a central banking thing where we're just watching the bottom 45% of Americans who have no investable assets that live paycheck to paycheck and all of their wealth is in dollars. They really do feel like they can't get ahead, right? And it's frankly not a wealth gap that's driving that. A lot of it's an education gap, right? It's just literally, if you look at the top 40 to 55% of Americans, they understand that they've got to get out of dollars and either consume or invest. And so what do? They end up investing and that ends up protecting their purchasing power and growing their wealth over time. Well, if you don't know that and you just sit in dollars, then you're getting absolutely punished right now. You know, 20 plus percent of all dollars have been created in the last 12 months. You know, we can look at all kinds of official inflation numbers. What people will say if you go talk to them and have no investable assets is I'm struggling. And so I think that's where the frustration is. How do you, you know, go after the boogeyman of the central bank? It's unlikely. You probably don't even understand why it's happening. So the next best thing is, you know, oh, those guys in suits and ties who are rich, you know, those must be the culprits. So let's yell and scream at them.
So, you know, it's interesting. My thoughts on inflation. My thoughts on inflation is we have no inflation, but everything's cost more. Right?
It's a pretty good way to put it.
Right? we have no official inflation, but everything costs me more. The other thing is, you know, there is this debasement that's going on by the central banks. And it is interesting about your commentary about, you know, the dollars and if you're sitting in dollars. And I am in the business. I am in the wealth management business. And I personally am disgusted about what this total inequality and more so during crisis. During the crisis times where, and I don't, anybody can be wealthy. I'm all happy about it. It's great. And that's what we try to do is help people create wealth and all that. But this divergence of the haves and the have nots and the desire to push up wealth assets to create the wealth effect, it only helps certain people. Like if you have a 401k, you're really happy. But how about all those people that don't have a 401k? And how about all those people that don't have equities because they can't risk those assets? And that's exactly what you're saying. They're left behind. And it's really kind of gross. And maybe that's why some of this really took on another form. But again, I think that a lot of people, unfortunately, are going to get burned. We see that, you know, GameStop was up at 480. People were buying in. Even the guy who hates the suits, you know, the gambler, you talk about degenerate gamblers. You look at Portnoy, and he's down 700,000. Why, smart guy, you would think, although he's just talking the stonks thing and all that, why he would get involved in these things at those levels, thinking I'm not sure where they're going, is pretty unbelievable. But the gamification of the markets and the ability then to press bets on positions and, you know, do what we did, is that, and even so, in the Robin Hood model of the gamification, is that something that you think is a good thing? Is it something that is a problem, the idea that this is just a big gambling opportunity?
Yeah, look, I'm kind of one of these people of the opinion that at the end of the day, it's all a casino, right? And sometimes that means that the casino is going to benefit some players over others. That means that there is a house. Usually the deck is stacked in favor of the house. Mm-hmm. And it means that we like to call, again, suits and ties with some cologne on. You know, they don't want to be called a gambler. They want to be called a trader or an investor or whatever. But they're at the table with everybody else, right? And they're leveraging – they're literally betting on future outcomes of assets and price movements. And so when you take that perspective, it goes, look, it's all gambling. And really all we did was we basically said, hey, rather than have to be a big hedge fund or have lots of money to play in this casino, now you can literally have $100 so you can play in the casino. And oh, by the way, if you don't have enough money to play at the table – that has a big enough kind of, you know, minimum buy-in, now there's these fractional shares. And so now you can actually play the same exact game, but you can play it with, you know, smaller dollars. And so there's pros and cons to that for sure. Like, I don't think it's black and white. I think it's kind of, you know, very gray, which means that the pros are we've drastically reduced the access to information, to communication tools and markets. Mm-hmm. I think that's generally a good thing for people, regardless of wealth or kind of geographic location. But there's also negative side effects, right? If you have a bunch of uneducated people who are basically going in and starting to invest, well, they're highly likely to lose their money. And so one of the conversations that I don't hear happening is it's not so much the gamification features that are bad. I actually think one of the things that people should be talking more about is what's bad is when you have a business model that is specifically predicated on you benefiting and your customers not. Well, right. And that's not just
I mean, I think a lot of this has also been because of the zero commission deals where you have payment for order flow. And, you know, everybody says, well, Robinhood stopped us from trading because they want us to lose. Now, Robinhood does better if you trade. Let's just get that straight. Okay. The problem was they didn't have enough money with the massive amount of requirements and they had some problems and they would have been over the regulatory limits. I'm not saying they're good for what they did and how they did it. But the fact is that, you know, there has never been a situation where the brokers or the other side is trying to help you out. And the other point that you probably are making here somewhere in here is that what about the educational component? You know, Chamath, I know he's a friend of yours, right? Chamath coming on and talking about how he bought a $115 call on this and rally, you know, pumping the troops up. And then Elon Musk coming out with a commentary. And then Mark Cuban with his commentary about, yeah, I can at $400, I can come up with a reasonable valuation of why that makes sense for GameStop. I'm like, dude, are you kidding me? How is that even? Everybody knows the valuation is not right, right? We know that, but it doesn't, but we're not suggesting that it can't go higher because of the buying orders and all that. I mean, isn't there some kind of dysfunction here?
Yeah, I think that the challenge with kind of picking any one person's analysis on any one security is there's always a counterexample, right? So there's always evidence that supports, hey, that person's being you know, malicious or irresponsible. And for every one of those, then there's the example of like take a Cathie Wood in Tesla, right? There's a period of time where Kathy Wood saying that Tesla was going to $5,000.
I remember.
Was insane.
Insane.
I mean, literally people were like, you're irresponsible. Why would you say that? Blah, 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 whatever. She kept kind of just allocating capital, kept, you know, sticking to her guns. And I think that either Tesla is, you know, before the kind of split, it's either close to that or has already eclipsed that. And so it's like when you start to kind of think through how markets work and how, you know, a lot of what ends up being like price predictions or directional predictions, people are right and wrong. And that's actually what makes the market. Now, there are people who have bigger platforms, right, than just kind of the average person. And so they've got to be more careful. But I do think that there's this element of as attention is drawn to individual securities and individual markets, what really people should be hammering on, regardless of how they do it, is just getting folks educated, right? Having people understand, hey, don't go put all of your money into a single stock. Hey, if you are going to take your rent money, if you get paid your rent money in a paycheck, don't go take it all and then put it into options and try to trade on something that's volatile and unlikely to work. And just really start to have people understand personal finance, portfolio construction, security evaluation, like all of those things. But when we get into a game of is GameStop worth $400 or not, we've had some investors say yes, we've had some investors say no. The scary part to me is not whether the market allows people to bet on yes or no. It's when you see proposals from politicians where literally I think it was a politician, I don't even remember who it was, wanted the regulators to ensure that the market couldn't get so out of whack that the stock would trade higher than the proposed value.
Yeah, don't even get me started.
Right.
Where would we be with that?
What's it worth?
Right, exactly.
Investors can't figure it out. How are regulators going to figure it out?
Yeah, regulators and politicians going to do a good job at that, which is just a big, big giant no on this. I agree with a lot of this, and I think that's really an important point, this educational process. And obviously not everybody has the capacity, desire, or time to spend doing all this. But also realize that, and I just get back to your other point about the analysis and who's doing it. And the fact is a giant, it's gambling, I mean, in a way. Is there really a difference between the guy who's writing up the odds and the predictions for a horse race, the guy sitting in the corner with a beer and a cigar hanging out the side of his mouth, shirt open at the track, you know what I'm talking about, right? And an analyst on the 12th floor on Madison Avenue in a nice suit going out for a 3-martini lunch? I don't think so. I really don't.
And I also think that there's this element of, I think a lot about sustainability. Right. And so one of my favorite questions to ask people is, are you buying something that you'd be willing to hold? Right.
Yeah.
And there are some people who are good traders. Right. And they have an advantage in trading. I'm not one of those people. And so to me, it's, if you aren't a trader, if you don't have that skill set, if you don't have experience doing that, don't do it. Right. It's kind of like if you're not a surgeon, you wouldn't go cut somebody open and try to do surgery. So don't try to be a trader. By the way, that doesn't mean you can't learn. That doesn't mean that you can't go and get educated. But what it does mean is that you got to know what you're good at. And you got to know what you're not good at. And I think that's part of the problem is if there's any knock against the kind of the gamification and lower barriers to entry, is it makes it much, much easier for people to do things that they might not be qualified to do. But again, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be allowed to do it. It just means that we got to really spend a lot of time and try to get them educated. Or if you're a product designer, you've got to design a product in a way that disincentivizes some of these behaviors that you don't want to see in your product, right? If you really don't want a lot of day trading, then you can do all kinds of things. There's a couple of products that I've seen that have basically been built. They don't offer options trading. They don't offer leverage. They don't, allow for very large transfers of capital. Like they put friction in there to try to discourage certain behaviors. Again, that might not be the right answer for every company, but there are things that people can do to try to change the user behavior if that's what they're attempting to do.
Yeah, and by the way, I've seen this. I've been doing this a long time. I've been doing this since the late 80s, okay? I've seen a lot of this. I've seen the Tilrays, and I've seen, the iOmegas. I've seen the days when things get kind of haywire and screwy, and then what happens, and everybody's all for it, and then once the bottom falls out, everybody's pissed off and starts suing. So that's kind of the
yeah. I think that one of the other crazy parts is if you look at something like a Tilray, right? Understanding the difference between market structure and realizing, hey, there's minimal float here, and that's what's driving the price up, and therefore that's going to cause kind of like this artificial scarcity, and if there's increased demand, you get a price appreciation, versus something like a GameStop, which is much more about momentum trading and kind of these gamma squeezes and all that stuff. Like in both of those situations, the stock went up a bunch in a very short period of time. But it was frankly for two completely different reasons.
Right, right.
And I think that's part of, you know, for those who don't spend a bunch of time in markets, that's what investors are trying to figure out, right? If you're a sophisticated investor, you're trying to not only understand is the price going to go up or down, what you're trying to understand is why. And if you understand why, then you're going to probably be more accurate in terms of predicting, well, what happens next.
Right.
And that's yeah. kind of the second or third question that I think is where the sophisticated investors spend their time. The problem is the uneducated, the unsophisticated, they just spend their time on question one, which is the price going to go up?
Yeah.
Right?
And by the way, I wanted to finish this one little quick segment on this. Yesterday, I was having lunch. I'm not kidding. I said, I'm going to go to YouTube. I'm just going to click on YouTube, you know, to see what's going on. I see this guy is live. He's got 6,500 active viewers on at that moment. This is a guy, I forgot his name, but he's from Canada. He's an older fellow, and he's taking donations, and he's talking about these various stocks, right? The, you know, the Wall Street hack stocks. And, you know, should I buy, should I not? GameStop this, AMC. And he's saying, well, yeah, it's at $100. Bruce, the guy's name was Bruce. Hey, Bruce. And they're giving him donations to ask questions. This guy, look him up. Who is this guy? Who is this guy? He's got a travel channel that obviously he turned into a GameStop channel, and he's got 6,500 people chatting like crazy people asking his advice on whether or not to buy AMC at these prices. How insane is that?
I mean, you know, there is one of these weird situations where when the attention of a society or a community turns to something, every person that has an incentive to participate will. And so there are some people who were on television talking about it. Why? Ratings went up. There were some people who were financial advisors who were very quickly putting out valuation frameworks or words of caution. Why? Because they wanted more assets so they could get more kind of management fees. There were people on TikTok who started to talk about it. Why? Because their videos would go viral. They would get more followers and views, right? Yeah. There was people on Twitter who started to talk about it. Why? Because it furthered the narrative in crypto, and that's what they focus on. And so therefore, they wanted to take people's attention away from GameStop and kind of siphon it off into Bitcoin and crypto. And so you just got to remember that, like, everyone has an incentive or a motive for doing what they do. And when attention shifts to a moment, I think that the internet, and that's every player on the internet, has really learned you can basically take those moments and then capture some portion of the attention for your motive. That doesn't mean it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just that's what happens on the internet. Because also at the same time that all the market participants are doing that, what's the media doing?
Yeah,
I mean, how many articles did you read about with the words GameStop short selling it, right? Like that's what the incentive is, to start talking about it and paying attention to it, because you're trying to further your motive.
So now you mentioned digital assets. What's your definition, and when did you get involved in this?
Definition-wise, I think it's just this idea. I kind of use a framework rather than kind of an explicit definition. The framework that I use is, we basically in pre-70s or 80s had an analog financial system. So all the assets were physical, right? Physical stock certificates, physical cash, physical deeds to homes, et cetera. Mm-hmm. In the 70s and into the 80s and 90s, we transitioned into an electronic CUSIP world, meaning that those assets went from being physical. Now there was these electronic CUSIP kind of entries on centralized databases that got traded around that represented the physical assets. So now you trade dollars right on your bank's balance sheet or in their database. You don't actually hold the physical cash. Same with stock certificates, et cetera. And so that transition from the analog world to this electronic CUSIP world basically built the foundation for the global financial system we know today. It was incredible, both from a coordination of capital and also intellectual resources. And it led to a massive inflection point in human productivity, right? And kind of that was this amazing thing. We're now going through a second transition, and that transition is one from that electronic CUSIP world to kind of this digital asset world. And so all of those assets are the same assets, right? If you were buying the analog version or the electronic CUSIP version, you were buying the same asset, actually usually from the same counterparty. It just was in a new technology form factor. Same thing now. So whether I'm buying it as an electronic CUSIP or as a digital asset, if I'm buying dollars, right, I'm still buying the same asset. I'm still buying it from the same counterparty in many cases. It just happens to be a new technology form factor. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that's so important is the people who saw the transition from analog to electronic early and actually acted on it, they had a massive advantage. They had outsized returns and they really, really benefited. And so if you kind of think of the guy who was the first to realize, wait, instead of calling up my broker, having them run over on the stock exchange floor and open outcry method to buy the stock, I can actually just execute it through my computer.
Open outcry. Well, man, you're bringing back some memories here. Okay.
Right. Okay. And yeah. So like all of a sudden, if I can just execute it through my computer, I have an advantage, right? I've got execution advantage. I've got information advantage. I've got, you know, price efficiency advantage, like all that kind of stuff. And so the same thing is going to happen here, right? Is the people who are early to understand that you can buy the same asset from the same counterparty, new technology form factor, they will have a big advantage. They will be able to capture alpha for some period of time. Now, just like in the electronic CUSIP world, that all got kind of commoditized down and now everyone's kind of on an even playing field again. And so, okay, here we go with disruption again. And so over the next kind of 10 to 20 years, again, people early will have that big advantage. It will get commoditized down, right? So if today in an interest-bearing account in the electronic CUSIP world, let's say you can earn, you know, anywhere between 5 basis points to 100 basis points, depending on, you know, what type of mechanism you're using. In the digital asset world, you can actually earn up to, you know, 8 or 9% interest on that same dollar just in digital form. That sounds awesome. Well, in 5 years, you're not going to be able to earn 8 or 9%, right? It may be down to 4 or 5%. And so there's this like financial incentive to get educated, do your research, and really understand digital assets, and then simply apply the same portfolio construction and kind of portfolio theory to your investment portfolio, but just swap out the electronic CUSIP assets for the digital assets. And I think that's kind of the big opportunity.
So are you talking about blockchain for equity and for dollar and kind of going that route, or is it something different?
I think that it's everything, right? What I mean by everything is there's basically 4 assets you can own: stocks, bonds, currencies, or commodities. Today, those stocks, bonds, currency, and commodities that you own are usually done in an electronic CUSIP format, right? What you will be able to do in the future, and some of it's there, some of it's not yet today, is you will be able to own stocks, bonds, currency, and commodities in digital format. Now, the currencies may be different. So for example, I would rather hold Bitcoin than dollars, mm-hmm. right? From a protector of purchasing power versus a degradation of my purchasing power. There are situations where, let's say, talk about equities. I can own a public equity in electronic CUSIP format that gives me basically 2 rights. I have governance rights, and I've got economic rights. Those economic rights are claims on cash flow or claims on assets of the business, right?
Right.
Well, in this digital world, I may at some point in the future be able to just buy kind of a blockchain-based stock. That to me personally is not that interesting. What's more interesting is all of a sudden, I basically can get a claim on cash flow and there's on-chain cash flow, meaning that literally as a business gets paid, my share of the revenue is immediately routed to my wallet. And so if I own, you know, 1/1000th of the cash flow, then all of a sudden 1/1000th of every payment just comes to me. It's almost a streaming payment of my share of cash flow of this business. And so that's the type of stuff where it is an equity, right? It doesn't come with some of the governance rights, or maybe it does. So there's kind of nuance
to it. But it comes with the ownership. Ownership is what you're talking about.
Yes, but what you're talking about for sure is you still have the same economic rights, and those economic rights end up actually being advantageous, right? In the another example is, think of it from an investor's seat. If I have a public equity today, what do I have to do? I have to wait for the quarterly reports. Mm-hmm. And sure, maybe I've got the resources. I can go take pictures of cars in Walmart, or, you know, get infrared insights into the oil reserves and, you know, somewhere right. in Oklahoma or whatever. Right. But for most people, they can't do that. And so they wait for those quarterly reports and they make investment decisions based on kind of infrequent information. Well, in this crypto world, what you find is all of the information is on chain. And so for the most part, what I can do is, on a literally minute-by-minute basis, I can be pulling in all of this data. And so I have greater access to information. I have more auditability of the information. And I can make more short-term decisions in terms of, if anything changes on a minute-to-minute basis, I know about it and I can change my investing kind of perspective. And so I think that just generally the electronic CUSIP world was better than the analog world, but so then will the digital world be better than the electronic CUSIP world. And that's
it's going to take a lot of work to have the old school companies wanting you at any level to have access whether it's daily, by the minute, or even further, to actually what's going on their books. Don't you agree?
So the legacy companies for sure, but that's kind of the whole thing, right? Is when a new piece of technology gets created, there's two things that happen. One is we take that new piece of technology and we try to apply it to the old world, kind of improve the legacy system. The second thing that we do is we take that new piece of technology and we try to create new things the world's never seen before. Most people will focus on taking the new technology and applying it to the things that we can improve in the old world. Not as interesting to me, right? It used to be interesting because that's where kind of the initial uptake is. Mm-hmm. Now I'm much more focused on how do we take this new technology and create things the world's never seen before. And an example I'll give you is, let's take the media business with the internet, right? If you were a newspaper owner and the internet came around, the early people on the internet that owned newspapers, what did they say? Oh my God, rather than deliver the physical paper, look at how great this is. We can just take a copy of the newspaper and we can put it on a website.
Yep.
And now people can go and they can literally look at a picture of the newspaper, read it all on this website. We're so smart. Well, that was an improvement on the old world, but it missed 99% of the value of the internet to a media organization. So you didn't have the ability to have a content management system. You didn't have dynamic headlines. You couldn't do any testing. There was no comment section. You couldn't update articles. You couldn't kind of churn things out at a quick pace. You couldn't put multimedia into the articles. Like all these little things that we now take as kind of table stakes for a media organization on the internet. In the early part, nobody did that stuff. They didn't understand it yet. So there had to be innovation. There had to be an understanding of the technology and how it got applied. And so I think that's kind of the phase we're going through right now with a lot of this digital asset stuff, right? Is it's very obvious how to take the digital asset technology and apply it to the old world. It takes time. You still got to do it. You got to have the funding for it. You got to have teams that have an appetite to do the work, all that kind of stuff. But like, it's pretty clear, hey, we could take electronic CUSIP stocks and we could just take the stock and rather than have it as electronic CUSIP, we just put it on a blockchain.
So okay, how do I get involved in this? How do I get – now, I understand about the currencies, right? I get all the – we'll call the group currencies, right, whether it's ETH or it's Bitcoin or whatever. This is a totally different discussion. This is a totally different discussion. How do I get involved in this as an individual?
Yeah, I think that there's really two main things that people should do, right? The first thing is people should start with what I call just like the large caps, right? And so just start with Bitcoin. Understand what is Bitcoin. How is it different than the legacy world? Why is it important? Like really, really go deep on what is ends up being 60%+ of the market, right? I mean, it's literally that much bigger than everything else. So go really, really understand that asset. That is the most important thing. Once you understand Bitcoin, everything else becomes much easier. The second thing that you've got to be able to do is you've got to understand that the open decentralized protocols will win over closed protocols, meaning that every time you see kind of a closed network protocol, where it's an enterprise or it's any sort of organization that's saying, hey, this is only for people in our little mini ecosystem, those are very, very unlikely to accrue lots of value because the open internet is where value accrues. And so then what you've got to be able to do is you got to go in. And what I always tell people is like, I'm not worried about the religious debate as to like where innovation is built. What I specifically look for is I look for market adoption, right? And so if you take something like, let's say, decentralized exchanges are fascinating to me, not because any other reason than it's very obvious the market is adopting them. And there's lots and lots of data that I can look at that shows people want this and people are using this. Now, which one ends up being successful, what technology kind of foundation is it built on, all that's up for debate. People will spend way too much time on Twitter and elsewhere kind of really going through that stuff. But if you take a non-religious kind of view of it, you just say, show me what's working. There's a lot of shit that's working. And so what people have to do is they got to go do that work, right? And they got to go understand kind of what is working, what do they want their investment thesis to be, where do they want exposure, and then kind of go and figure it out from there.
So give me one name besides Bitcoin, for example, one thing. Does it always have to be a coin? Does it always have to be a cryptocurrency? Can it be just a technology somehow that a company is building to create this without the other side of it being I'm putting my money in it?
Well, I'll take it even a step further. So what can actually happen is you can actually get something built on top of, let's say, Bitcoin, right? So if you take Bitcoin, most people think of that as an asset, right? And I'm going to use Bitcoin as the kind of example, but this applies to a lot of these ecosystems. There's Bitcoin, the asset, meaning I could buy Bitcoin on an exchange. I can hold it in a wallet and the US dollar price can go up or down or sideways or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But then also there is Bitcoin, the payment network, which is literally named the same thing, but that refers to, rather than Bitcoin, the asset, it refers to the rails on which you can send value back and forth. And so you can send Bitcoin across those rails. You can send messages. You can send things across the actual Bitcoin network itself. And so when you get into that being kind of a layer one or the foundational layer, you got the asset, you got the payment network. Then there was a layer two built on top of it, you know, Lightning Network and a whole bunch of other things. Now all of a sudden you get applications built on top of Bitcoin, or you can have applications built on top of the Lightning Network. And so what you start to realize is like there is an entire ecosystem. And if you want to take a technical purview of this ecosystem, what you can really do is you can start to unpack what are the pros and cons of the Bitcoin network? What are the pros and cons of the Lightning Network? How do they work together? Right? What do I think is viable? What do I think is not viable? All that kind of stuff. Or what you can do is you can take what I consider much more of a kind of consumer-led investment strategy, which is saying, hey, look, the underlying infrastructure of the technology, I'm not technical. I don't understand all the nuances there. What I'm going to look at is I'm going to look at where the market is adopting, because that's actually where the market's showing this works. And then I'm just going to look at the application layer. So I'm going to start to understand, well, what are the exchanges that allow you to transact in this specific asset? What are the custody solutions, right? What are the things that are using this as the underpinning that have some sort of consumer-facing product that is being adopted by the market? And so I think that's like the key difference here is you can be more of the protocol investor. You can try to go figure out the technical pros and cons of individual protocols, or you can look at the actual applications, right? And there's no right answer in all of this, but what you have to just hammer home is the world is being rebuilt. So there's a complete rebuilding of a system. There's the legacy system, and there's this new system.
Right.
The new system may be better or worse.
Right.
That's up for debate. So, but what I know is that a new system is being built and is worth learning about.
Right. We just have a few more minutes to talk, but give me your real quick answer, right? Bitcoin, or pick one of them, you know, store of value, currency, investment, which, all the above, none of the above?
Oh, I think it's all of the above. When you just think of a currency in general, it's got to be a medium of exchange and a store of value. I think it does both of those. And then obviously the fact that it's digital, on a blockchain makes it a kind of a cryptocurrency. So I think it's all of the above.
I mean, the only pushback I'll give you is I can't have my currency, theoretically, in something that's going to move 10% a day, or that could move 10% a day. And maybe that will all play out and calm down over the future when things kind of get a little bit outside of the – we're not in the wild, wild west. We're in the wild west. So we'll take out the wild, wild part of it right now. Okay. In terms of the newness of it. Right.
Well, here's what I always say to people, right, is it didn't move in 10% a day, right? Because if you denominate it in Bitcoin, if you denominate it in dollars, sure. But if you denominate the dollars in Bitcoin, right, well, then the dollar's super volatile. Right? But that's not how people think about it.
That's a good way to look at it. I never thought of that.
I got $100, right? That $100 can buy a certain amount of goods. And I'm going to hold that $100. And I don't think on a day-by-day basis is the dollar going up or down in value. I just think of it as $100. Bitcoin, same thing. I got 10 Bitcoin, right? If I have 10 Bitcoin, some people will think of it as in US dollar terms, what is it worth? What's the volatility? Other people who have denominated kind of their world in Bitcoin, they just think of, I got 10 Bitcoin, right? They don't worry about any sort of denomination in other assets or currencies. And so one of my favorite data points I always talk about is if you go back to the 70s and you denominate the stock market in dollars, up and to the right, perfect 45-degree angle, looks amazing, everyone's a genius. If you then denominate that same stock market in gold, the stock market's down since 1970s, right? Now, does that mean that the stock market's bad and people shouldn't invest? No. It just means that you can use data, and cut it all kinds of different ways to build a framework for investing. And so you've really got to understand, what is my worldview? How do I think of the kind of native currency in which I use? And then how does that apply to investable assets in my universe?
Yeah, that's the famous line from Dennis Gartman, which talks about something in terms of, the price of a stock in terms of Bitcoin, in terms of a Japanese yen, in terms of the dollar. Cool stuff. Quickly, Dogecoin, 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 Doggycoin, whatever you want to call this thing. Can you explain to me? We know kind of, I think we all know what's going on with this thing, but why is Elon Musk getting involved in this?
Look, I think that a lot of these guys, they have kind of two key parts to it, right? They really like the memes. The memes have value. They really believe in kind of the memetic aspect of life, of kind of the meme is the message, if you will, at this point. And so the more that they joke around about it, the more it becomes a thing, the more it becomes a thing, the more it gets adopted, the more it gets adopted, the price goes up. Now, it would shock me if Elon Musk actually owns a bunch of Dogecoin. I think that he'd probably be getting pretty close to the line in terms of like market manipulation stuff if he was actually profiting off of all this. Right. But my guess is that it's a joke. He and a bunch of other people think it's funny. I saw Cuban tweeting about it and a couple of others. And so they're going to joke around about it.
It's the same group. As someone said today, I think it was Josh Brown, whether you like him or not, on something. I heard this and I said, he says, somebody said, billionaires posing as folk heroes.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's everyone likes to hate the billionaires because they're rich. At the same time, I think that the billionaires would have the same type of insults to hurl back, right?
No, I'm sure.
Financial advisors or advisors want to hurl it at investors. So I tend to think that they're all playing a game with their own motives.
Right. Last question about cryptocurrency. Michael Saylor, MicroStrategy. Loaded
legend.
Up. I've known him for a long time. I've made some money and lost a ton. Back in 2000, when he cooked the books wrong, I lost a huge amount of money. I just want to say that. He was like really back. I don't know if you're from back that part, but back in, I think it was 2000. The year was 2000. And he cooked the books. He brought forward sales with contracts on a five-year basis, and the stock cratered 50%. In a day. There was a big lawsuit, big class action. I actually made some money on the class action. But now he's into this, going into Bitcoin for his balance sheet. Just bought a bunch more recently. You think this is a smart thing for corporations to do?
I think that Michael Saylor, because of this decision, right? I can't speak to kind of all the other stuff. I don't have all the details, whatever. But because of this decision, will likely go down as one of the smartest business executives in the kind of 20-year period we're talking about. Let's call it 2010 to 2030. And really, it is kind of threefold. One is he did work. He came to a conclusion. The market will determine whether that conclusion was correct or not over the next couple of years, but he came to a conclusion. Two is he had the courage to bring this to the board, to do the work, to convince them and kind of be willing to act, right? So kind of the courage to act. And then the third is the conviction to not only make the first move, which was about $425 million, but to continue to bet down over and over and over. Kind of the idea that the best investors in the world, you know, double down on their winners and kind of really press them as hard as they can. Well, he went from that initial $425 million to now he's done over $1 billion. And so when you see that, and he's continuing to buy more and more, which
40% of the market cap of the company is owned in Bitcoin.
I mean, there's an argument to be made that the business at this point, you know, he's got a cash flow software business that's quite profitable. But if you think about kind of how people are getting exposure to the business, they're looking at it for a synthetic exposure to Bitcoin.
Yeah, of course. That's what it is. Yeah. It moves with it. Again, I know you're pressed for time. A couple things. You have a great podcast. Everybody should listen. You can find it on YouTube and Spotify and Apple iTunes. There's videos and all that. You have a great list of guests over the time. You've had Raul Paul, you've Kathy Wood, you've had Mark Cuban, you have the Mooch. A lot of the names that I've had over the years. By the way, I told you my podcast go back to 2007. So I got these guys many years ago, a lot of these people, made them what they are today, I think. who was one of your favorite guests or conversations from recent time?
So I'm going to give you two, one on Wall Street, one not. By far, my favorite person to talk with, and I've talked about it a bunch as to why, but Kathy Wood from ARK Invest. I think she's just got a very unique, kind of fresh, innovative approach to assets, businesses, markets, and kind of investing. So she's just always a joy to talk to, and she's always been very gracious with her time with me. So she would be the person on Wall Street. And then in terms of the person off of Wall Street, I had a gentleman named Mackenzie come on, and he literally was an average person, right? And I say average, not in a kind of a condescending way, but just when you think of people usually come on the podcast and they've got something to sell, they've got some, you know, heroic thing they've done in their life or whatever. He literally lays flooring in Canada. He DM'd me on Twitter and said, if you ever just want like a regular Joe to come on, I'd love to do it. And so I brought him on the podcast and we talked. And the reason why he ended up being one of my favorite people to ever come on was he said one thing to me that just, I think, really, really embodied what a lot of people think when they think of investing. He said to me, I am not trying to take over the world. I'm simply trying to create a better life for my wife and kids. Mm. And yeah, to me, that was just, you know, again, regular Joe guy who's got a blue collar job, who's taken the time on his nights and weekends to educate himself, to make sure that he understands markets, he understands, inflation, investing, and kind of all these different things. And then choosing to take his hard-earned money where he literally expends physical labor to get and then decides when and where to invest it in hopes of not dominating the world, but right, instead simply just providing that better life for his family. That's, and I think that really, really resonates with a lot of people where they say, look, I don't need to be a billionaire, but I'd like to have a little bit more money, and I'd like to have a little bit more safety, and like to have a little bit more free time. And so when you think of it in those terms, it's, you know, people end up being just kind of trying to figure it out. And I think that's what makes a lot of this investing stuff so much fun.
Yeah, great. Good stuff. Hey, give me a quick bang, bang, can you?
Bang, bang.
All right. Anthony Pompliano, the Pomp. Listen, we're going to have all the information on how to get in touch or to watch or to listen over on the show notes over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, episode number 700. Anthony, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. 700, man. You are killing it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, buddy. Bye. That's going to be a wrap for this show, episode number 700 with Anthony Pompliano. That was great. That was really interesting. I mean, the whole idea of how he explained what digital assets are, not just necessarily the coin, but the design, the platform. Kind of interesting. Hopefully you learned a lot from that. I learned a lot from that. I am going to bid you adieu, and I'm going to see you again next week. Thanks so much for joining me. I'll see you soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.